This morning, calling State versus Donald Coughlin. It is 19 AP 1876. Appearances, please.
It appears by Assistant Attorney General Wynn Cobb. Attorney Bob Graham appears on behalf of the Coughlin.
Good morning. All right, the lineup this morning, 25 minutes followed by 30 and 5 minutes in rebuttal, correct? All right. Justice Krosky is not participating in this case, and so we will proceed.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Wynn Collins, counsel for the State of Wisconsin. The State respectfully requests that this Court reverse the Court of Appeals insofar as it reversed 15 convictions in counts 7 through 9 and 11 through 22 for Coughlin's sexual assaults against his younger stepson and nephew. As Coughlin hasn't sought review of the 6 convictions in counts 1 through 6 for sexually assaulting his older stepson, those are not before this Court and remain undisturbed. This case comes down to fidelity to precedent and faith in a jury's verdict. This Court should reinstate the 15 convictions under review because the Court of Appeals irreverently strayed from the core legal principles regarding the sanctity of precedent and faith in a jury's factual findings. The State and Coughlin disagree in 2 key respects, but one thing is not in dispute. Coughlin acknowledges that there was evidence that he had sexual contact with the victims. As he notes on page 7, the victims testified to, quote, numerous instances of sexual contact between the defendant and each of them. The 2 disputed areas are, first, a divide existing between the parties regarding the standard of review, and second, the parties undertake their review very differently. The State, in adherence to precedent, seeks to look at the totality of the evidence, whereas Coughlin looks in a vacuum at 6 pages of trial transcript. The first area of dispute is purely legal, whereas the second involves the application of law to facts. Let's begin with the standard of review. Evidence sufficiency has a frequently stated and sometimes misunderstood standard of review. The standard is de novo regarding the lower courts, as this Court has identified in cases such as State v. Smith. But the review is highly deferential to the fact finder, as this Court has stated in State v. Rowan. The State adheres to the standard of review with fidelity to precedent. Under this highly deferential standard to the fact finder, no court should reverse unless, as this Court stated in State v. Palinga, the evidence is, quote, so lacking in probative value and force that no trier of fact, acting reasonably, could have found guilt beyond the reasonable doubt. This Court stated it more bluntly in Thomas v. State, and it's noting that a court will not upset the trier of fact's determinations as to weight and credibility unless it's inherently and patently incredible as a matter of law, and that it conflicts with nature or fully established or conceded facts. In State v. Scholler, this Court again noted that the record has to be, quote, devoid of evidence on which a reasonable jury could convict. Now, Coughlin does note on page 13 of his brief that he doesn't quibble, as he says, with the State's presentation of the standard of review, but he, on multiple occasions, asks this Court to, quote, adopt the appellate court. Coughlin has flipped the standard, directing this Court to the Court of Appeals opinion and away from the jury's factual findings. This Court doesn't adopt the appellate court's findings in de novo review, and so the State simply asks that this Court reaffirm what it has said before, and that is, we are de novo regarding the lower courts, but we are highly deferential to the fact finder.
Mr. Collins, can you help me, please? Would you agree that it's up to the DA to determine the charges, right?
Correct.
Here we've got very specific time frames with respect to each child. So you've got a very small time frame, fall of 1989, spring of 1990, fall of 1990. So when we talk about the standard, and of course it's deferential, wouldn't there need to be evidence in order to support when things happened, especially in light of the fact that there's 3 different boys
So saying something like it happened to one of us every week and happened, meaning it could be something criminal or something not criminal, how is that enough to tie to these specific circumstances? So, I mean, hopefully that makes sense, the question. I can rephrase it if it didn't. It was very long. I apologize.
That's okay, Your Honor. It actually brings in multiple doctrinal principles. So let's take a little moment to look at the law that we're going to have to apply to these facts. And the law is stated by this court in State versus Hurley, where it says a person does not escape punishment because they sexually assaulted a child unable to testify with clarity as to date and details.
Right, and that's very important. So, for example, the DA at the end of the evidence, in one of these instances, I believe it was with respect to the stepson, he testified that things happened during the entirety of 1990, could have amended the charge instead of breaking it down into spring and fall, right?
They could, but there's a fact that gets a little lost, and I understand why it might be missed. And that is both of the stepchildren testified that they spent summers at their uncle's farm. And so there had to be a delineation. We knew that there weren't sexual assaults by Donald Coughlin against these child victims in the summer period. And the significance of fall or autumn to spring is that Coughlin used the fall deer hunting season as a ruse to be alone with the children to shine deer. And so there were multiple more instances where he was alone and where he engaged in the sexual contact with the children in the deer shining. In fact, when we look at the nephew, there is no spring. There is just this shining period, the deer shining period, when Coughlin used it as a ruse to be alone with the children, would take them to secluded areas, and he would rotate which child was in the front seat of the vehicle, and he would then have the child in the front seat touch his penis, or he would touch the child's penis. He specifically did that with his stepson, the nephew. It was a situation where Coughlin would touch the child's penis. That is what the victims testified to. To your point, Justice Dallet, about specificity, I think that takes us back to State versus Hurley and another key premise of Thomas, which I mentioned earlier. Thomas makes very clear, and this court stated, quote, the inability to connect the alleged crimes with a particular date goes to an issue of credibility and thus is a matter for consideration by the jury. So when there's a lack of certitude, when there is lack of specificity as to date, this court has already answered that question. That is a weight and credibility determination for the jury to decide, not an appellate court.
As long as there's evidence to support it, though. There still has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, right? I mean, here's my question. So you brought up the cousin. The questions that were asked of him were whether there was some sexual activity that involved the defendant. And then, questions about being driving around shining, when it happened. What is sexual activity? There's been testimony here that some of the sexual activity was the boys masturbating themselves, and you make a concession to the Court of Appeals, it's in a footnote, that doesn't qualify as sexual contact, right?
The state made that concession. It's sort of a moot point here because the theory of guilt is what was the jury instructed. So whether or not there was a broader definition isn't before this court, because to examine the theory of guilt, you must go to the jury instructions.
Okay, so them touching themselves does not count in terms of these counts. It is criminal conduct in other types of crimes, but not here, correct?
It is outside the theory of guilt is how I would phrase
it. Okay, so outside the theory of guilt, however you want to phrase it. So that doesn't count. So when you've got a description of these multiple things happening, including the grouping it then under sexual activity and then going through the years and the fall and the summer and asking, was there sexual activity? How would we know beyond a reasonable doubt that sexual activity wasn't outside of the theory of guilt?
That is part of the problem of what the Court of Appeals has done. It views 6 pages of trial transcripts. You have to look at the totality. So if we look at, for example, Record 303 on page 24, the nephew was asked, quote, but did you observe him masturbating someone in the front seat? Answer, yeah. Did he ever masturbate you while you were in the front seat? Answer, yeah. And now I'm going to use not the victim's names. And the older stepson, yes. And the younger stepson, yes.
But how do we know and all of it, sexual assault, it appears to be, right? But how do we know that that was specific? Like, how does that link to the fact that we know that, for example, that there are, my math is bad, 10 counts with respect to the stepson how do we know the two of those counts didn't involve one of those other boys? Because there's three boys, because there's multiple time frame, and because we're talking about conduct that was and was not sexual activity, even giving inferences, how do we get there?
The key word was at the end, the inferences. So the problem with the Court of Appeals opinion is it effectively undercuts one of the critical premises of Palenga. Palenga stands for the premise that circumstantial evidence may prove a crime and reasonable inferences can be from specific facts can be led to the ultimate question of guilt or not guilty. The problem with the Court of Appeals opinion is saying that if a victim does not testify with direct evidence, you must say, yes, he sexually assaulted me at least once from this period to this period. That's great if you have it. But if you don't, Palenga tells us we can rely on circumstantial evidence. Jurors are free to make reasonable inferences. And this court has repeatedly said that you don't escape guilt by sexually assaulting a child repeatedly. Let's just take a moment and look at a hypothetical. If a child says, my uncle sexually assaulted me, and they report it as an adult, law enforcement's going to want to know when. And let's say the child can say, it was the Christmas after grandma died. You could go to the adults and find out when did grandma die, and you could say, okay, in December of 1992, this defendant had sexual contact on one occasion. What the Court of Appeals has done here is create a windfall for the pervasive sexual abuser. If you sexually assault a child for many years in multiple forms, in multiple locations, if the children cannot testify with specificity, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Well, Mr. Collins, that's kind of a broad way of looking at it, right? So I prosecuted these cases, and I heard them for two straight years in Milwaukee County. The prosecutor has choices, right? So in that circumstance that you're talking about, you make it a broader time frame, or you charge three counts within a, right, the three counts within a certain amount of time, or you make it a two-year time frame, or you make it the issue, as I see it, and I obviously, I've made that clear, is that this is a very specific breakdown of time frame that was not amended at the end of the evidence coming in, and so isn't that what we're bound by?
We're bound by the charges, but I would disagree that it's a very narrow time frame. If you look at the various counts, they're multiple months in duration. They're talking about sexual activity, including the Coughlin touching their penises, and they're talking about it as a weekly occurrence. So it's fair for the jurors to say, we have 4 months here, and he's doing it weekly, so we have about 16 times in the family home with the younger stepson, and we have it anywhere from 16 to 32 times of deer shining. Is it reasonable to infer with Coughlin's proclivity to be interested in children's penises, with all the other evidence, when we look at it in total, is it reasonable for the jurors to say, I believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it at least once over this four-month period when he was repeatedly being alone with the children, when he used it as opportunities to engage in sexual contact, when he groomed the children, when he focused on their penises, and when the victims testified directly that he had sexual contact with them?
Counsel, what legal issue are we deciding here? Question mark. I'm going to rephrase that. And that is, it seems to me that parties agree on the legal issues and that the disagreement is regarding the sufficiency of the evidence. Is that statement correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a novel issue before this court on the theory of guilt. It often gets sort of missed in an evidence sufficiency case because it's not in dispute. There's a few distinct cases where it does come front and center. Here, through briefing, it's clear that the parties don't disagree on how the court should establish the theory of guilt. And so I think the briefs effectively answer that question. Then we get to the application.
Okay, so there is no legal question for us that displays a difference of opinion between the defense and the state. Is that correct?
Generally, I mean, I think Coughlin noted, let me just double check a moment. You know, he noted in page 12 of his brief that he's in general agreement with the case law. We don't have a line by line, but it certainly would presumably mean he doesn't disagree with this court's determination Hurley that you need not prove the specific date. He states that he doesn't disagree that he has the heavy burden in an evidence sufficiency claim. Where I think there is a little bit of gray, Your Honor, is with regard to the standard of review. I think this court should clarify what it has said before, but perhaps more directly, which is courts sometimes jump to the de novo and bypass the highly deferential. And I think that's how you end up with you know, request to adopt a lower court's findings.
What bothered the Court of Appeals, that is what was a novel issue, apparently, as to what standard is the evidence to be measured, against what standard? Is it the jury instruction or the verdict? Both sides in this case agree that it is the jury instruction rather than the verdict form. Is that correct?
Correct.
So we seldom take cases just on sufficiency of evidence. It sounds like a lot like error correcting here. So give me a lifeline, will you, to say why this case is more than just sufficiency of the evidence determination.
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, when the state petitions, we have no idea that Coughlin is going to concede our presentation of the law. So there is still the novel issue before this court that is still yet unresolved until this court issues an opinion. And so just because the briefs may be sufficient to address the theory of guilt, that is still an issue before this court.
But don't all of the cases that were referred to stand for the premise that it is the jury instruction, or at least lead inexorably to that point, because that's why you're conceding it?
No, I'm not conceding it. The Coughlin conceded our presentation.
Well, I don't know. In the Court of Appeals, you didn't really address the issue. According to paragraph 15 in the Court of Appeals, when I say you, I mean the state. You know, one might expect the state to argue that our review should be guided by the broader definition of sexual contact as set forth in the jury instructions. However, the state makes no such argument, and instead acts as though the inconsistency did not exist. Therefore, this is an unusual situation. So I don't know what was going on.
Yeah, in the Court of Appeals, the state put in a footnote that we recognize the Court of Appeals' error correction, so we preserve the argument should it come before this court. But for simplicity in an error-correcting court, we operated under the narrow definition, preserving review under the broader. We're here now, and both parties have agreed to the broader definition, and the jury instructions prevail. The other point that is important with this case, Your Honor, is that we have doctrinal principles, but we have other areas where this court could offer clarity. One of the points that I think gets lost a bit by the Court of Appeals is it creates a conflict in precedent. And we have the Fawcett case. We know that you can charge over multiple months. But if we accept the Court of Appeals' opinion, we create an oddity, an absurd result, where you can charge but never convict unless the victims can be cajoled or influenced into saying, yes, I know what happened over this time period. We don't want to do that. We want victims to come to court and present their account as best as they can. Another part that gets lost when looking at the facts, because the Court of Appeals viewed it in a vacuum and focused on 6 pages of trial transcript instead of the entire picture that this court has instructed, a point that gets lost is the victims explained why they couldn't testify with specificity. Both of the victims testified that they couldn't recall with specificity, and precisely because of Coughlin's pervasive abuse. And so I think we have to marry the precedent, and we have to have a process where you can charge a case and a process where you can convict if the jurors find the evidence credible, if the jurors weigh the evidence and make the credibility determinations. I think an undercurrent in the Court of Appeals opinion is a distrust of juries, sort of a premise that the jurors wanted to convict Coughlin because he was a bad guy. But actually, the record proves the opposite. The jurors acquitted Coughlin of count 23 involving a fourth victim. If this was a jury just ready to rubber stamp conviction, they would not have acquitted on that count. This was a jury faced with a difficult decision at hand, as every child sexual assault case is. The jurors were tasked with delayed reporting, and delayed reporting is common in child sexual assault cases. The record shows that Coughlin made threats against the children when they were young not to report. And so this is a textbook case of an abuser close to the children finding excuses to be alone with them, forcing them or encouraging them to engage in sexual contact with them, threatening them so they don't report, and they have the courage as adults to report. Admittedly, when they can't testify with specificity as to he did this on this date and this on that date. And so the jurors were tasked with that, and the court instructed properly under the law. Some For all of you who've been circuit court judges, instructions you could probably say in your sleep, right? Beyond a reasonable doubt. What is the last line? You are to search for the truth and credibility.
Whatever the truth may be.
Exactly.
That's the last line.
Yes. In full, it's while it's your duty to give the defendant the benefit of every reasonable doubt, you are not to search for doubt, you are to search for the truth. Yeah. And credibility, instruction 300 opens with, it is the duty of the jury to scrutinize and to weigh the testimony of the witnesses and to determine the effect of the evidence as a whole. You are the sole judges of credibility, that is, the believability of the witnesses, and the weight to be given. That's a perfect marrying with evidence sufficiency law that says it is the jury who takes ambiguous testimony. It is the jury, when they're faced with lack of specificity as to date, to weigh that evidence and make credibility determinations. It is not for an appellate court to second guess, to search for doubt, to take all the reasonable inferences of innocence and to overturn 15 child sexual assault convictions. I think it's really made clear when this court looks at the circuit court's evidence sufficiency review versus the Court of Appeals. The circuit court, in record 309 on page 20, observed that the state was, quote, nice in some ways for not charging more sexual assaults. The court went on, there could have been more charges of this than what was charged, even tenfold in some cases. How do two courts, reviewing a highly deferential standard to the fact finder, when the defendant has a heavy burden to overcome the sanctity of a jury's verdict, when you have a jury who carefully weighed the evidence and acquitted on count 23, who was not looking to just find guilt, how do you reverse all that without creating a break with Fawcett that says this is an acceptable charge, a break with Stevens, and a break with Hurley? That is what we ultimately have here from the Court of Appeals decision. And what we ask this court to do is, of course, resolve the novel issue before the court, the theory of guilt, and how we set up the framework. In this case, that is presumably an easy decision since the parties agree on that. And then apply that theory of guilt with the unbroken precedent and reinstate the 15 convictions. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
May I begin? May it please the court, again, I'm attorney Philip Brehm, and I practice out of Janesville, and I represent defendant appellate Donald Coughlin. I take the position that the Court of Appeals was correct in its sufficiency of the evidence analysis, that the relevant counts should be dismissed with prejudice. As to the remaining six counts, the sentences should be vacated, and the defendant should face resentencing on those counts, and the sentencing court should be allowed to consider any and all relevant evidence related to sentencing. I need to put a caveat on the issue for which we're ostensibly before the court for. The state takes the position that when there's a discrepancy between the jury instruction and the jury form, that the jury instruction should prevail in that situation. And I'm not arguing that today, and I'll say that not because I agree with that concept, but really because it's advantageous to my client to do so in this situation. And for that reason, I would ask that the court not create binding precedent on that particular issue.
Hold it. You're advancing something that you don't necessarily agree with? Is that what I heard you saying?
For the purposes of my client, the person who I represent, and that's who I have to represent.
As a matter of law, what are you presenting to the court on that issue? What are you advancing is the law? Or aren't you advancing it? I understood by reading the briefs that the two of you were in accord with that premise. Maybe I was mistaken.
I think there's a subtle difference there. I'm conceding the point for purposes of this appeal today. And I recognize that if I was representing another defendant on another occasion, I may take a contrary position. But I can't do that today because I represent Donald Coughlin.
Well, how can we? Well, we can do it. We can do it because we're certainly up to the job and capable of it. But what you're saying is you should decide the sufficiency of the evidence, but not use any measure against which to apply it. I mean, that's part of what you're hearing.
And I guess I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that for purposes of the argument, the court assumes this without necessarily deciding that that is, in fact, the way it should be in every case going forward, if that makes any sense.
So what would the rule be coming out of this case?
My position is that, boiled down, this really is a sufficiency of the evidence issue, and that's what the court is addressing.
I understand what you're saying, but I want you to tell me what the closing rule is. What's the line in our opinion? How does it read? So that everyone in the state knows what the law is.
And again, I'm asking the court not to make that decision and instead to assume.
Yeah, but that's our job. We don't take a specific case just to create an outcome for one particular person. We take cases because we declare rules of law, right?
And I understand that. It just puts me in a difficult position because I don't feel like I can present the opposite position to the state on this fact pattern. And the reason why I take that position, it comes down to a double jeopardy analysis. For purposes of double jeopardy, I want things to be as broad as possible for my client. The state charged one count for all these time periods. I personally question whether you can do that in a situation like this, but that's what the state did. They didn't provide any specificity as to what each of those counts entailed as far as actions. And they implied at points that there was more than one act for any given time period. And as Justice Dallet pointed out, the state could have charged under 948.025. You allege, hey, there's at least three conducts that took place during this time period. Jurors, you don't have to decide which three there are. You just have to decide that there are any three during that time period. The state did not do that in this situation. They did it, I think, with count 22, but they didn't do it with the remaining counts that are at issue. And therefore, I take the position that with regard to the relevant counts here, any relevant charged conduct would merge into those single counts for each time period in question. And if the state were now to try to charge defendant after this appeal, assuming the defendant were to prevail today, you could not allege a count during any given time period because it would necessarily have merged with the prior count. So in other words, how would this new count be differentiated from the old count? So that's why I'm taking the position I'm taking, and that's why I am agreeing with the state on this particular issue. The state points out that it's important to uphold the jury verdict. We need to defer to the jury. It provides case law that says there's few legal principles that are more indisputable than a jury's in a better position to weigh evidence than a reviewing court. Fine, that's a maximum. There's another maximum that says the state has to prove their charges beyond a reasonable doubt, and if they're unable to prove those beyond a reasonable doubt, that the charge should be dismissed. And that's whether it occurs pre-trial or at trial or at the appellate stage, as is the case here. The state argues that there's more than enough evidence to support guilt on the counts. The state analyzes the victim's testimony. It argues the jury gets to resolve conflicts in testimony. And we're not, from the defense standpoint, asking the court to resolve conflicts in testimony. We're pointing out the absence of testimony here. And it's important to look at the totality of the evidence, like the state suggests. And I would argue that the defense would point out that the witnesses first gave general testimony. They were generally asked, how frequently did the charged conduct occur? They gave a general estimate as to how often. They were asked some questions about general time period as well. But then they were asked specific questions. And they were asked specific questions about each time period that was charged. But in the process of doing that, they were not asked the right questions. They were asked in a way that did not answer the question for the jury. Did sexual activity occur during this time period? And sexual activity included the charged conduct, which was either the defendant touching the victim's penis or the victim touching the defendant's penis. But it also included conduct that was not charged. And that would include the parties masturbating in each other's presence without necessarily touching each other. Now, from the standpoint of Mr. Coughlin, assuming that's true, that may have been sexual abuse to masturbate in the presence of children. It may have been criminal in nature, but it wasn't what was charged by the state in the information. So my position is that when the victim says there was sexual activity during each time period, what the victim is really saying, the charged conduct may have occurred during that time period, it may not have occurred during that time period. And I would point out that the victims never said that it in fact occurred during those time periods. And I want to give an example that kind of illuminates that. As the state has indicated, the victim's testimony has to be taken as a whole for purposes of the appellate analysis. Let's assume we get that general testimony from the victims. Oh, it happened about once a week to once a month, generally speaking, and it happened over a time period, several years. All right, that's general. Now the victims are asked about each specific time period. And let's say that the victim is asked, did Mr. Coughlin touch your penis or did you touch his penis during this four-month time period? And let's say the victim says no. This isn't inconsistent with the general testimony. It is merely specific testimony that clarifies the general testimony.
But the victims didn't say no.
What's that?
The victims didn't say no.
This is my example, and I think it's just a step before what happened in this case. But let's say that the victim said no. I think under that circumstance, if a court reviews the case for sufficiency of the evidence, they would have to conclude that there isn't a factual basis for that charge. Because the victim just said it didn't happen. Who is the jury in that situation to determine that they're in a better position than the victim to know whether or not the conduct occurred?
Counsel, we're talking about two adult men who testified to things that happened to them over a five-year period that they testified happened on a weekly basis, at least during the autumn, and most importantly, that these are things that occurred 23 to 28 years before they testified. Do you really think it's realistic? Do you think it would enhance their credibility if they were able to say, oh, yes, I remember specifically that occurred on this day 23 to 28 years ago? The law does not expect children, when this happened to people, when they were children that many years ago, to be able to pinpoint with that level of specificity. What I'm reading the case law to say is that you look at the totality, the jury looks at the totality of the evidence and can draw reasonable inferences from the testimony that's provided, which was quite specific and quite detailed about what happened to them. But for them to be able to say, you know, 23 to 28 years ago, I remember specifically that this
exact act occurred on that day? That's not realistic, is it, counsel?
I think it is realistic for them to answer, did this conduct occur during this 4-month time period? Otherwise, why is the state charging it in that fashion?
My point, counsel, is that they testified to repeated acts of sexual abuse that happened, they said, on a weekly basis. They testified to the jury it happened on a weekly basis, at least during the autumn. Why isn't that enough?
Because I take the position that, as the state indicated, you have to look at the totality of the witness's testimony. And the totality does include a clarification of the general testimony with specific testimony. And I think that's where the problem lies in this case. In this case, the victims were never, in fact, asked whether the conduct occurred during each of the time periods. They were asked in a way that was unacceptably vague because it included both charged conduct and uncharged conduct. And that's why the evidence is insufficient. I get it. The state talks about how hard it is for victims to remember things after the passage of time. Details melt together. Victims may not remember what happened and when. But, you know, the state suggests that somehow the defendant's exploiting that. My argument is that that's simply proving somebody guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's our system. And if it's hard to prove a case, that's the state's burden to deal with. It's going to be a challenge, but that's the challenge it takes when it charges. I take the position that this didn't have to be a difficult case for the state to present. The right question was not asked of the victims. It may have been that the state was overly confident and didn't feel that it needed to ask that question. It may be that the prosecutor lost focus. Maybe the prosecutor failed to realize that he had strayed from the definition of what sexual assault was for purposes of this trial. And maybe, just maybe, the state's question was deliberately formed in a way that it was because the state wasn't convinced that it was going to be able to get the victim to testify the way the prosecutor hoped the victim would testify.
Counsel, with regard to the testimony of the stepson, I note that a specific question was asked in this fashion regarding conduct that is, I would say, chargeable under the circumstances here. And the response was, it happened weekly. Question was, at times did he ask one of you to masturbate him? Yes. Did that happen as well at the house? Yes. How often would this happen in the home? Weekly. Can you specifically address that portion of the evidence and why that does not comport with sufficient evidence?
And I think that gets back to my argument that you have the general testimony and then you have the specific testimony, and the general testimony doesn't necessarily prevail if there's some specific testimony that clarifies the general testimony. That's my position. So another... But you could have a situation where a victim is asked, you bring in a victim, did this ever happen? Seemed like it happened all the time, every day. And then they're asked questions and then they start to be specific. I don't think it would be fair to just look at that first statement, seem like it happened every day, and conclude that that provides the factual basis for any possible charge during an entire charging period. At some point, I think you have to be reasonable in what the inferences are, and I think you lose that if you don't look at the totality of a witness's testimony.
Fair enough. But why isn't the response that it happened weekly at the home sufficient? I get your argument that seems like it happened all the time, but here we have some specific evidence. Why should we discount that? I didn't quite understand how the general then should supersede the specific.
And I guess I would have to look closer at the full context of that, but I don't think the allegation was that each and every one of these incidents happened in the home. I think there was the allegation that some of them happened while deer shining and things like that. So it wasn't necessarily a situation where the victims lived in the home for the entire time period that they had talked about.
Well, counsel, the testimony from the stepson was exactly this. Question, how often would this happen in the home? Answer, weekly.
Okay. And again, I don't know the full period of time that they were in the household. But I take the position that it was reasonable to expect the prosecutor to ask the question that was important in this case. Did Mr. Coughlin touch your penis in this four-month time period? Did Mr. Coughlin touch your penis during that time period? And again, if the state had done that, I don't think we'd be here today. And I will tell you that based on my experiences, I'm not a prosecutor, but I've certainly dealt with a lot of prosecutors. Prosecutors go into trials knowing what the elements of proof are. And then during trial, they meticulously present a factual basis for each element through legitimate evidence.
And what do we do with the stepson's testimony? Again, he's testifying 23 to 28 years after the sexual abuse. And he testified there was a lot of sexual abuse going on, so it was kind of hard to keep track of all of it.
And
we really expect a child to keep track of it when it's happening weekly. Again, the stepson testified it happened weekly in the home over a five-year period.
But again, if that's a big enough problem, then the prosecutor should potentially argue for a longer period of time and potentially proceed under Section 948.025. The state suggests that in this case, bad precedent could be set if the Court of Appeals decision is left to stand. I don't think that this case is going to open the floodgates to sufficiency of the evidence arguments. The defense is not asking this court to turn precedent on its head. We're asking the court to limit the holding to the unusual facts of this case. And really, I think it comes down to, is there sufficient evidence to support these counts standing? And I don't think this is a fact pattern that is likely to be recurrent. I think the key is that prosecutors typically are going to present a prima facie case during trial. They're not going to leave this type of evidentiary gap out there for issues to arise. And if the state presents its prima facie case, then there's not going to be this type of appellate challenge. Just checking if I have anything else that I wanted to cover. There was an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. The main issue raised by the defense here was not fully preserved during trial. I think trial counsel probably missed it. He didn't argue it in closing, and he did not make a motion to dismiss based on the theory that I'm raising. Unfortunately, trial counsel was not available for the Mockner hearing, and the defense was unable to present corroborative evidence of ineffective assistance of counsel, so that's why we did not pursue that issue further. But again, I take the position that if a victim says charged and uncharged conduct occurred during any time period, that that's not the same thing as charged conduct in fact occurred. And again, that's why there is the insufficiency of the evidence, and that's why I am asking the court to adopt the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address two key points made during my opponent's argument to clarify before addressing the theory of guilt and evidence sufficiency. First, opposing counsel said that the state could have charged under 948.025. That is legally and factually incorrect. That law was enacted in Wisconsin Act 1993, Act 227. It was only viable for count 22, and that is why count 22 is repeated sexual assault of a child, and the other counts are not. Secondly, opposing counsel said in discussing beyond a reasonable doubt, that's our system. But he's not arguing to 12 jurors. He's arguing to six justices. And the framework here is not beyond a reasonable doubt. The framework here is a highly deferential standard to the jury and a high burden for a person raising the evidence sufficiency claim. So let's not morph reasonable doubt in front of a jury versus a high burden that is highly deferential to a jury when on appeal on evidence sufficiency. And now coming to theory of guilt. I had left that out of my argument because I thought we agreed apparently more than we do. The reality is you cannot get to sufficiency review without establishing the theory of guilt. It is a critical component in the framework. It's the first step of sufficiency review. And that is because it sets the boundaries of double jeopardy. We can't argue a case on a hypothetical. We can't argue a case without boundaries.
Let me tell you one of the things that bothers me about this case. You're advancing now. In fact, I'd say you are proclaiming. How can you do that? Well, that's the very thing that you are proclaiming against what the state did at the Court of Appeals, not taking a position. You know, how can you not take a position, you say, to opposing counsel? You didn't take a position on that.
That's completely incorrect.
Well,
the state.
Look at page 15 of the Court of Appeals argument.
Your Honor, the state put in its brief a footnote that said this is an error-correcting court, so we will argue the narrow theory of guilt to simplify the issue. So the state did set the boundary.
What bothers me about this is that the transcripts reveal substantial inadequacies in the questioning in terms of what's chargeable and not chargeable and not being clear. And I feel as though, because the testimony is that it's pervasive, that you want us to be moved by that and kind of overlook the infirmity of the questions which lacked specificity. Push back on that, because that's really my sense, that this was less than what we would often like to see, she said with great understatement. So push back on that.
Yes, Your Honor. The state is not asking you to be moved in this case. We're asking you to apply the regular boundaries. I think about it a little bit in a conversation I had with my daughter this very morning, which was, if I asked her, students listen to their teacher, you're a student, you listen to your teacher. Now take that to the nephew. The nephew says, I'm only with Coughlin he only is touching my penis during deer shining. Deer shining is in the fall, and it happened over these years. What is wrong with the jurors reasonably inferring that the sexual contact happened in the fall during the charge period?
If it was just one individual, I would absolutely. And if it wasn't lumped with conduct that is clearly not part of the theory of the defense. The problem that I'm clearly having, and I may be the only one, is that you do have multiple individuals. And even in the portion that was just pointed out by my colleagues, it talks about weekly, him or it's either the stepson or the nephew. So how do we parcel that out when it's asked in that way? It could have been asked in a way that, did this happen to you weekly? And it could have been not sexual activity, but did he masturbate you or did you masturbate him weekly? Yes. That would be it. That would be the answer. But that's not what we have. So how do you reconcile that?
Your Honor, once again, we're looking at a single sentence in a vacuum. We're ignoring the fact that the nephew testified how Coughlin would rotate which child was in the front seat. Each child would, on various occasions, be placed in the front seat. And the nephew testified specifically that he witnessed Coughlin having sexual contact through the form of masturbating all three of the children in the front seat.
But was that fall of 89, fall of 90, fall of 91? How do we know that the rotation, that only one child was in the seat for that fall when it's broken down so specifically? How do we know beyond a reasonable doubt? How did the jury know? Actually, not us. How were they able to know beyond a reasonable doubt?
You may answer the question, and then you must conclude.
Thank you. By looking at the totality of the evidence as they were instructed in jury instruction 300, by weighing the evidence and resolving any ambiguity as credibility and weight determinations.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the interesting arguments. The court will adjourn when counsel for the next case are situated.